Do we all as individuals that make up the collective of the health service, do we have a shared set of values, or at least values that we all can ascribe to? But that's not really much good if we're not able to translate those values into the way people experience us and the way we experience each other. And that's the behaviour piece.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the HSE Talk and Health and Wellbeing podcast. My name is Fergal Fox, and I'm delighted to say today we're joined by the CEO of the HSE, Bernard Gloucester. As always, we'd like to thank you for joining us, and please give us a like or a follow on Spotify, wherever you're listening to our podcast. Bernard, you're really welcome to the HSE Talk and Health and Wellbeing podcast. Thanks for taking some time out of your busy schedule. It's very important for us to have, you know, the HSE leadership support the health and wellbeing agenda in the HSE. And I know that you were at our launch of our second Healthy Ireland in the HSE implementation plan last summer. I really appreciate that. But I suppose you've been involved for a while. You know what we're doing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can go back to the origins of Healthy Ireland, I guess, long before I became the CEO of the HSE. I had a whole life in the health service, predominantly centered around the Midwest and for periods of time, the West, but pretty much around the Midwest. So I can go right back to the origins of Healthy Ireland. And I think as health service staff, professionals, leaders, people on the front line, Healthy Ireland was kind of, you know, it became very much a slogan, which was a good thing, I think, in terms of generating debate and narrative. But perhaps the slogan just became more the slogan, I think. And for a while, we struggled with it. You know, it was around the time, I suppose, when the economy was still in pretty significant difficulty. So investment was low. We know that investment in prevention is on the lower side, albeit thankfully increasing. And I guess depending on which part of the service you set in, you were either focusing the Healthy Ireland debate on early intervention, prevention, or in the case of people already with disease, from further deterioration. And so there were lots of different parts to it. I think what struck me when I came back to the HSE just a little under 12 months ago was the renewed commitment to a very specific implementation plan. So I think it was the second go, really, at an implementation plan. And what I liked were, it had that focus on implementation. And I think coming away from very esoteric conversations and very fluid kind of things, I think it creates that possibility. So, but if you look at the length of time since Healthy Ireland as a government policy was first launched,
yeah,
to us getting to that, you can see just how much the challenge of implementation features in the Irish Health Service, which is why timely implementation is one of my critical areas to address.
Yeah, that was your big message at the conference. You know, this is a great plan. Let's get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose you've been consistent on that implementation message. One of our, you know, you mentioned we've got increased investment in health and wellbeing through the Enhanced Community Care Programme and through the likes of Sláinte Care Healthy Communities. We've been able to get staff, you know, way more integrated, I think, with general health staff. You know, our health and wellbeing workforce is small, but we're kind of integrating and making health and wellbeing everybody's business in the health service through programs like Making Every Contact Count and through our tobacco program. But I was reminded, I just heard in one of your interviews with the Irish Times that you started in South Hill in your own health board journey. That's where we launched one of our
Yeah. Look, I mean, Limerick is very close to my heart. I still live in Limerick. I was born in the city and I live in the county now. But despite having spent 3.5 years as the CEO of Tusla based in Dublin and now a year as the CEO of the HC based in Dublin, I have huge connections to Limerick. And going back to the start of my career, I was a young social care worker in the late 1980s. And in the Midwestern Health Board. And at that time, jobs were very temporary in nature. You were in a job, you were out of a job, and so on. And I guess that was a point at which I was deciding myself what it was I was going to do in life. And so you kind of did lots of different jobs, but I had done some social care work on the north side of the city, in Moyross and Ballinanty, and a little bit in South Hill. And then at one point in time, the caretaker in South Hill, who's still there, he's a great guy, Paul, he's still there. He took some leave. He was, you know, he had a lot of leave coming to him or whatever. And there was a period, I think, of about 7 or 8 weeks where the caretaker's job was vacant in the old health centre in South Hill.
Right.
It was really the old health centre. And so I did that, yeah. And it was great, really, to go back there this year at Christmas.
Oh, you were turning the lights
on. At Paul's invitation, yeah, to turn the lights on. So kind of a 360, I guess, in some respects. But, you know, South Hill is a community where it has changed so much over the years with regeneration in the city and so on. But I think what it is, it's indicative of communities that have gone through whole periods of different types of marginalisation. And we know exactly the socioeconomic impact, the impact of housing on health, the impact of access to education, all of the factors, all of the determinants of health and the life chances of people. Yeah. And so I really was delighted to see the healthy community piece because, you know, we can be the HSE and the government can be the government with Healthy Ireland and we can do our piece. But ultimately, we are talking about a fundamental sea change for whole communities. And if that doesn't happen in the communities, for the communities, by the communities, then it's not going to happen by us forcing it and so on. You know?
Well said. We heard from a young women's group that had been through our Healthy Food Made Easy program on the day the Healthy Communities launch. But it did seem to be that South Hill Hub is really vibrant. And you know, that kind of community engagement and the partnership that we have with the local authority, they're very significant change agents about those social determinants that you just mentioned.
Yeah, and I guess we have a very different way of looking at it now. You know, I've said for a couple of years now in the different roles that I've had, and certainly in this role, even when it comes to things like disability and mental health and social care for older people, Ireland, not unlike other countries, but Ireland's whole social care history and education history was very much based on a paternalistic model where, you know, we knew best, the state knew best. We knew best, we knew what you needed, we knew what was good for you, we knew what wasn't good for you, and we were going to give you what was good for you, and we weren't going to give you what wasn't good for you. And that very much paternalistic role. And there was nothing wrong with that in the sense it wasn't ill-intended. It was where, I guess, professionalism had got to at that point in time. But, I mean, I think if you're to take a real human rights-based approach to things and if you're to take a kind of a community development model and a community development dimension to things, you just don't do it that way. You don't get the same success. You don't get the same impact. And so I think now things like healthy communities, I think they create that possibility. And like I said, I think it's of the community, it's for the community, and it's by the community. And when it's around things like lifestyle and lifestyle changes and awareness, that's far more successful than necessarily any instrument we can bring into a community.
Yeah. So you mentioned there that you're a year into the job now, you know, and you came in talking about access, implementation, like we said, and public confidence in the HSE. Where are those three?
How's all that going?
Yeah. Well, we've seen you've had challenges during the year. Mm. You know, we've had a significant strike. You've been batting challenges around budget. Mm. You know, it's not been straightforward. But I guess that's the nature.
I've been batting all of the challenges I envisaged. So nothing in the past year has really been a surprise to me.
Yeah.
Probably, other than the enormity of it, is more real when you're in it than when you're looking into it. So, I mean, if I take the three priorities, I guess I didn't kind of make them up. They were all evidence-based priorities, but I did have a fair say in them. Access, fundamentally, access has always traditionally been about waiting lists.
Yeah.
Somebody waiting to see a doctor, somebody waiting to see a therapist, somebody waiting for a freedom of information request, somebody waiting to get paid for something. And access is a fundamental issue that has been a big part of health and social care and public services for so long. And, you know, there's a wonderful story about 5-6 times a year, 700,000 people are on waiting lists. That actually is not the issue. The issue is the length of time people are waiting. That fundamentally determines the impact or not of the access issue for them. And so I knew that was a real challenge coming. You only had to look at things like waiting lists, like trolley waits, like so on and so on. And I guess what I've tried to do is maybe three things. I do everything really with a now and a next. I don't believe in being a CEO that has a vision and I'm only focused on the vision and you won't see the vision until I'm finished. You know, you have to deliver now for people. People who want public services need them now as well as the people in 5 years' time. So the now was very much about refocusing the organisation to much more simple plans around things like access. Have we got it all cracked? We haven't. But, I mean, if you take one of the biggest ones is the whole trolley thing, and there's fights about numbers and whose numbers was right and so on. I now publish every day, sometimes three times a day, the four key numbers that describe the entire trolley situation. And I think people see that as a fairly transparent thing, but what good is that, sure, if you're just counting them? And so we got rid of winter planning, because winter planning had become associated with a shopping list for extra goods, and the extra goods got approved by government usually quite late in November. And by the time they got spent, the winter was over. And so there was a lot of mismatch. So with the support of the minister and the department and the secretary general, I got agreement to kind of get rid of that system. And we went for kind of a full in-year plan. And that has made a difference. There is no doubt we still have a huge challenge. And, you know, I'm not really that worried about what the big number is. I'm worried about the fact there are people today on a trolley waiting to be admitted to hospital.
It is challenging when you have that the waiting list, and we can reduce the waiting list by getting care in other ways. But you also have to build up a service to be sustainable.
You do. But I mean, I think in the second half of last year, compared to the second half of the previous year, we actually reduced the amount of people on trolleys waiting for admission to hospital by 22%. Now, that doesn't mean anything today to the person I call Mrs. O'Neill if she happens to be down the road from me here in the hospital on a trolley waiting to be admitted. So that's the daily grind. But certainly we can do something about access. Waiting lists last year, far more people came onto waiting lists than we ever anticipated. But we took far more people off than we were even targeted to do. And by the end of the year, we had reduced the whole volume of the waiting list by about 2.7%, which most jurisdictions in Europe aren't doing at the moment. But more fundamentally, the real issue for me was we reduced the average length of waiting time by several months. It's now down to about 7.5 months. That's pretty significant.
Yeah.
And so I focused on that. So that's kind of going okay, but it's a daily grind. The issue for me with access is trying to get health professionals to understand patient safety is as much, if not more so, an issue for the people waiting for a service than the people in the service. People who are waiting are at serious risk, and we have to treat them with that same level of a patient safety lens. And when we do that, then access becomes a different priority for us. So that's access. Timely implementation. Well, look, let's go back to the subject you're talking about today. When I launched the implementation plan last June, I made it very clear to the team, well, let's not launch the plan. Let's set a date and come back. So this summer, we're going to come back, and I'm kind of interested in seeing what we've done. And I'm not interested in dressing it up to say, weren't we great? We give ourselves a big pat on the back, and we did 7 out of 10. I'm interested in a real debate about what did we achieve? What didn't we achieve that we thought we would, and why? And in that why comes the identification of the obstacles. And out of that comes the real story as to why. Is it an obstacle to do with resource? Is it to do with time? Was it overambitious? Or is there something in the culture of the organisation that's affecting the implementation? And that often is the case. We hide it with other things, but that often is the case. And so I'll see by the summer, what did it look like? And then we know whether or not we have an implementation plan that we really can crack and implement. And so that's the timely implementation. And public confidence, well, look, maybe I'll let others judge that. Yeah. Public confidence is a very, there's lots of measurements for it, but it's a very hard thing to really measure. Healthcare is so central to people.
Yeah, I was going to say,
Very hard to measure.
You mentioned that the mammoth size that you can only get your handle on when you're in the organization and seeing, like, I can't imagine the variance of pressures that are coming into your office. But like everybody in the country has a personal stake in the health system. And so it is sensitive.
Yeah, I remember a former Minister of State one time involved in services for older people saying to me, you know, Bernard, everything I'm doing for myself because I'm getting older.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of an interesting narrative, isn't it? Look, one of the things about health services and healthcare workers and health professionals and HC staff, we all live in communities. We all have families and we are all users of health services. And there's no probably greater reason than to want to make it better for that. Public confidence to me, you know, it gets informed sometimes by very kind of big headlines and stories of the day. And there isn't a week goes by that I don't deal with a pretty lightning rod story that might be in the media. I know the whole backstory of it that most people will never know. That's one bit of public confidence. But the real public confidence comes from me in how many people will relay a story of their experience of the health service and that story is an increasingly good story. That to me is the real measure of public confidence ultimately. You know, if my Mrs. O'Neill leaves hospital today, she's sitting having a cup of tea in her kitchen tomorrow with her neighbour. What would she say was her experience of the health service? And what will her neighbour draw from that in terms of her anxiety around using the health service or the hospital or the GP or whatever it is? And so public confidence is built on people's experience. And so my focus has to be on people's experience. And I spend quite a bit of time privately meeting people who have had good and bad experiences of healthcare. And that informs and shapes a lot of my thinking. At least once a week, I will spend time with a member of the public who's had an experience.
Very good.
It might be two this week and none next week, but yeah. It averages out. I reserve about a day a week.
Yeah. I heard you met John Wall. He's one of our advocates for men's health. He came out to one of our webinars last year. Really strong voiced.
Yeah, John's a great guy. I saw John on Twitter. I was familiar with him on Twitter when I was in Tucson. Even when I was a chief officer in the Midwest, I think he started his kind of campaigning journey. And I'd never met him. And when I got this job, I reached out to him and said, look, could we have a chat? And he came in and we had a chat very privately, and I asked him would he come and talk to the leadership team with no agenda, just of his experience, and that was quite powerful and quite impactful, I think, because I had the whole leadership from the whole country there. And so I've done that a couple of times. 2 weeks ago we did that with Adam Harris.
Alright, very good.
So rather than it being around As I Am and his organisation, it was around our awareness as people and as professionals on the autism and the whole spectrum of issues associated with autism. And let's be honest about it, we're quite short on our knowledge and insight into mental health. So people's experience, but that's the public side. What you wouldn't see is, you know, times I would sit in people's kitchens. Sometimes people have had very, very, very difficult experiences in healthcare, some very tragic outcomes. You know, one of the high profile cases last autumn that had started about 2 years before I came here was the case of the very unfortunate and tragic case of Emily, who was raped in a nursing home by a healthcare professional. And that, you know, was all over the headlines and all of that. But people see those headlines, but you know, I sat in a room with Emily's family, and you do hear and understand and feel a very different sense of people's experience when you do that. Can you resolve everybody's issue? No, you can't. But you can certainly shape your priorities and shape your agenda and shape your focus. And that in turn helps me to challenge the leadership of the health service. And I think anyone who works with me will probably say, well, I don't know if they'll say it's fair or not, but they'll certainly say I give them a fair challenge.
I'm
pretty unrelenting about that, because at the end of the day, it's not about me. I'll be gone. Like, CEOs come and go. I'll be gone. People will retire. But Mrs. O'Neill doesn't get paid. Mrs. O'Neill's experience has to be first.
Yeah, you've used that personification or that persona, Mrs. O'Neill, fairly consistently.
Yeah.
As a message, like it's a call to action really for staff, isn't it? To keep in mind service user first. And it's interesting you give us examples there of bringing the service user into your leadership team to, you know, the voice can't be hidden.
So Mrs. O'Neill, I can't proclaim to own the construct of Mrs. O'Neill. Mrs. O'Neill came in 2013 after the then government decision to create hospital groups. There was this kind of view of what is going to happen with the community services, and I was managing community services at the time. So out of that came a process that led to the establishment of community healthcare organisations, or the 9 CHOs, as they're called. And it's amazing, we're now about to change the structure.
I think I met you actually as part of the consultation.
Yeah, so I was involved in that, and because I was one of the most experienced regional people, I was asked to go on to the team. And so when the report that led to the establishment of the 9 CHO areas was written, Miss O'Neill was a demonstrable example in it. It's just a simple paragraph. Miss O'Neill's a widow. She lives alone. She has diabetes. She has arthritis. She has chronic heart disease. She simply wants good quality healthcare services from professionals who talk to each other.
Yeah.
And I keep saying to people, that paragraph was written, and I always remember it. I did a master's thesis in 2019, and it was a really long thesis around lots of things. I don't bore people with it, but I started and finished that thesis with Mrs. O'Neill. So Mrs. O'Neill came out of that whole design of community healthcare organisations as that descriptive of the patient. A widow, lives alone, 79, arthritis, heart disease, and so on, and wants good quality healthcare from professionals who talk to each other. And what I keep reminding people is the reason that paragraph was written was to describe the need for integrated care. And so I keep saying to people, you know, there are books written the world over on integrated care. Some of them are fantastic. Some of them probably not so. But the point is, I keep saying, look how simple Mrs. O'Neill's ask is. Just look how simple it is. And look at how complex we've made the response.
Yeah.
And my job is to take the complexity out of the response so that Mrs. O'Neill gets what she needs and what she wants.
Yeah, some of our health and wellbeing colleagues have added to your kind of persona, Mrs. O'Neill, and suggested some supports that Mrs. O'Neill or her family could potentially use in the community, like social prescribing. You know, a lot of older people are struggling to get back out post-COVID. There's still a fear there, and or the likes of the Living Well program, where we do support people with chronic conditions, demand it to do that self-management piece, you know, to keep people like that well at home. I think that's definitely one of your priorities, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, look, alternative care is a feature of life. People are now living longer, thankfully. Ireland has exceeded the EU 27 average in terms of increase in life expectancy. And that's because of policy changes and lots of things that have happened. But some people do need care, and there's just no question of that. So there's always going to be a role for that. But if you look at the multiplier in the demographic of the people who will be like Mrs. O'Neill, and unfortunately that generation and the generation behind it do have a significant prevalence of chronic illness and chronic disease, we do have to find those ways of that entire support system and that network. And that's really what community healthcare networks and integrated care teams for older people are about. They're about treating people at the lowest level of complexity. And I've seen the ICPOP teams, I've seen what they've done, and I've sat with one of them with a relative, and that's exactly how it should be and how it needs to be.
Yeah. I want to come back to your drive on the change program that you have around the regions and all that. Like you mentioned there, that, you know, you were party to previous changes. You know, you've seen LHOs, ISAs, CHOs, you've seen it all.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're like, we're about to make it or cross a big milestone in the development of 6 new regions.
Mm.
So can you give us an update about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, some people say back to the future and back to the health boards and all of those kind of good things. I mean, essentially, the regional construct as we're now facing into it came out of the Sláinte Care Policy Platform in 2017. And the core of the rationale for that was to say that, look, the community services and the hospital services are too siloed from each other. They're not geographically aligned. They're not integrated. They all work well. They're all nice people, but they're not geographically aligned or well integrated. And so that needs to happen if we're to have this, what they call a shift to the left. In other words, moving away from an acute-centric model of care. Now, we're going to be dependent on acute services for a long time, so let's not fool ourselves. But if you're going to create that shift, you need to integrate those services. And there was a lot of debate. There was going to be 6 independent regions, like 6 HSEs with legislation. And I think rightly, the decision was made not to go that route, but just to create 6 administrative regions within the HSE. And the reason is, otherwise you'll have to create 6 HSEs, and they'll all have a centre, and it'll all repeat the same cycle.
Yeah.
But when I came to this job, there's a lot of work done on the design of the regions, a lot of really good work done. But I had been through a fairly significant structure change design and implementation in TUSLA. I had lived through all the other failures of structured designs in the health service. And they weren't failures because they were bad designs. They were failures because we didn't implement them on time. By the time we got to implement them, the time had run out and someone had come along with another great idea. And like you said, LHOs and ISAs and CHOs and the whole 9 yards. And so I have a very clear understanding of structure. And when I came back here, I said, yeah, I can't go with those 6 regions unless I change the centre. Because the centre as it was structured would choke the 6 regions, quite frankly. It would just, they wouldn't be able to function.
Right.
Because the control was in the centre.
And it was a devolution.
Yeah. And when we talk about structures and we talk about culture, we have to talk about power. We have to talk about power when we talk about public services and structures, because positions are really important. And people look at structures and say, where am I?
Yeah.
Where do I go? Who do I report to? Where do I fit? And so I very much, through learned experience, and I've learned all the faults of it, I'm very much more of the view structure is useless. In fact, the best thing you can know from a structure is it'll do no harm unless it facilitates what it's intended to do. And that's the integration of services at that simplistic level, and unless it facilitates some reasonably shared vision that leads to a change in culture and an improvement in culture. So we now have a revised centre. People are saying, oh, you still have a centre, you're loads of directors. Yeah. Yeah, but you're always going to have a centre. And if you didn't have it in Dr. Stevens, you'd have it in the 6 regions. So you're going to have a centre. But it has a fundamentally different purpose from next week on. And we have 6 regional executives. And probably the greatest structural change in that is the 6 report to me. Today, a chief officer or a hospital group CEO will report to a national director. The national director will report to chief operations officer. Chief operations officer reports to me.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is a big delayering. And rightly so.
You came in and hit the ground running. I think on your first or second day, you brought all the CHO chief officers and all that.
Second day.
So like you tried to create that culture piece straight away.
Yeah, completely.
Well,
I mean, I think it's important when you come into a job like this, it is important to come in and it's important to listen and hear and inform your thoughts by people's experience. But it's also important to come with a plan. So I'm contracted to be the CEO of the HC for 5 years. Let's see how that goes. But 5 years is a very short time. I'm now coming up next week on 12 months in this job. Kind of happy enough where I've got on the structure change piece. But to me, that's kind of just an enabler. That's like doing the groundworks for a building. I have to get on with the serious business now. And the serious business is the improvement in access, the improvement in productivity, the improvements in performance management. And that underscored by a culture that positions the public interest in the right place.
Yeah, I think that's important because like no more than like we just said there, there's a certain amount of our staff cynical about the change. And then like you're highlighting now the why, like in some of the presentations I saw about the change in the regions, health and wellbeing, improved health and wellbeing as a basic was being called out in those. Like mm-hmm. this is one of the reasons we're trying to improve things.
That's right.
So I guess we need to work on the whys, don't we?
We do. Look, and people are cynical by their nature when it comes to things like organisational redesign and change. And I always say to staff, look, let's try and stick the course together and be sceptical. So, like, I'm happy for someone to be sceptical. I really am. And I'm happy for someone to question what I'm doing. And I'm happy for someone to be very doubtful about some of the things we're doing. I just would say to people not to become cynical. Because I think when we become cynical, we really do ingrain a negativity into the culture that makes it very hard to move forward.
Yeah.
And ultimately, no matter how cynical or sceptical any of us choose to be as staff, I do keep reminding people, the public don't get paid to be frustrated. If we're frustrated, at least we get paid to be frustrated. So we really have to keep the eye on that ball. So sceptical is good, cynical,
I remember expressing a lot of frustration to a general manager in Tullamore once about it was recruitment. You know, we had to fill in this form and that form, and we knew we weren't going to get posts filled. And he just said to me, "You know, this is the situation we're working in at the moment. Like, basically, this is your job." Mm. You know, like you said, that we are getting paid, and like we have a recruitment pause at the moment, which is causing challenges across the system. Like, it is part of the role.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah. And all of those things bring frustration. So basically what I'm hoping to do is to move to a position where the 6 regional executive officers will now have a pay envelope. And then even if one grade code like management admin or any other nursing or any other exceeds its national target, it'll only be within a region. And so one region won't affect the other. Now, the one thing we're all going to have to get used to is there is an employment control. And I keep saying to people, you know, I'm not saying that what we have is what we need. I'm saying what we have is what we have. That's what we can afford. And we have to demonstrate how we use that and how we best use that to the benefit of the public. We then look for more to respond to need. But we don't just go and recruit what we can't afford. And that's really the problem I've been trying to iron out for the last 6 months now. And it's going to take about 2 years to resolve it properly. Nice. But I think we're well on the way. And so people will start to see recruitment again, I think, in a number of areas. There are about 3,000 new jobs to come into the system this year, despite the overshoot last year. So there's a lot to be hopeful for, but it is frustrating. Controls are frustrating. They're very frustrating for people. But I think we have to have more honest conversations too. So, you know, let me give you an example. Let's take the Healthy Ireland implementation plan. If the people behind that plan come and say to me, look, we really, really, really need 35 more whole-time equivalent positions to do that. Well, rather than me saying, well, look, I'll approve them in principle and let's see how we get on getting the money for them over the next period of time. That's a pretty false construct. I have to say to people right now, I don't have 35 full-time equivalents funded for that. So all I can do is reuse what I have to give you some. And then hope that in next year's estimates, I can convince of the need to do that. But the notion that we can sort of go ahead and do it in the hope that we get the money, that's what led us into the trouble we're in. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose we have been lucky in some areas in health and wellbeing to get increased investment, particularly in tobacco.
Hmm.
And I was telling you about our increase in engagement with you know, smokers in relation to we the service reached out and engaged 19,000 people last year. And one of the key pieces that was additionally funded last year by the department was nicotine replacement therapy, you know, offering that free NRT to people and taking that, the cost out of it, basically. It was a barrier. So the we're kind of really, we are proud of that kind of the quit campaign and all that work that's going on. And, you know, tobacco is still a massive issue and, you know, causes, leads into so many health inequalities and leads into so many different chronic diseases. But one of the key headlines that we've been able to use from the campaign is that we have more quitters than smokers. And I know.
Of which I'm one.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I think we have done a huge amount with the tobacco policy in this country. And I have said the current tarnish, I think, deserves enormous credit for the standing up in the face of the smoking ban. And as a smoker at the time and as someone who liked to go out and socialise, I was one of its greatest critics. And but I think that policy initiative has made a fundamental difference to the level of social acceptability.
It's changed the culture, that smoke-free workplace.
Absolutely, completely. So I really think, you know, that step, that very brave step, deserves enormous credit. I think then the HSE, through various iterations, has had campaigns which have been remarkably increasingly successful. You know, I think how many people remember the television ad campaign of the man who...
Jerry Collins,
and that very generous man and his family. And I remember being at a health leadership event where after Jerry died, his family were acknowledged, if you like, as a way of concluding that campaign. And his life story, that had a huge impact. But I think the quit campaign is undoubtedly, along with being able to do the nicotine replacement, I think it's undoubtedly been a huge success. I didn't use it. I gave up smoking before that kind of, I suppose, intensity around that campaign, albeit the Jerry Collins one had happened. And I think for lots of people, you know, the challenge of being a smoker and the challenge of giving up and staying quitting. You know, I certainly fell foul of that once or twice. You know, I remember at a point in time not smoking for 5 years and then smoking. And that shows you the vulnerability that can happen with it. But I do think there's an increasingly strong awareness amongst younger people. I have to say I fear the vaping culture around young people, and that's not to get into the political debate about the legitimacy of vape or not. And, you know, some people would say, well, vape was a harm reduction to give up smoking, but for a person who never smoked to start vaping, I'm not really sure that's kind of what was intended.
But we're very clear from our tobacco program around our vaping advice is to keep well away.
Yeah, I do think we're going to end up with a version of a quit program on the vaping side, because I think that will come home.
There is a lot of concern around, I suppose, what we see as a big increase in youth vaping and the use of those flavours and like they're literally advertising to the youth audience.
Yeah, and it's starting to develop a new social acceptability. Yeah, do you know, like when I was a young fella, which is a very, very long time ago, smoking was a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
It just was. And you kind of got stuck into smoking at 13 or 14. So you wonder just a little bit about the psychology now of that replacement. But that said, I mean, I think the quit campaign is just something now that has grown enormous energy, has demonstrated evidentially its value. And I think the only thing we can do, both as a health service executive and indeed with the support of central government, is to keep expanding it.
Yeah. No, we are trying to do that. I suppose just to highlight to listeners that March is another one of our promotional quit months. So you'll see our ads on the television, on all public media. And that call to action really kind of cuts through to the public, you know, that there is, like, from our Healthy Ireland survey, we know that 92% of people want to do something to improve their health and well-being. And the smokers, like you said, the big message is don't quit quitting, you know, even if you've...
It's 100%. And, you know, I guess I would say to people, you know, there is life after smoking.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine that when you're a smoker, because, you know,
it's a crutch.
It's a highly addictive substance. It's a stress reliever. It's whatever you want it to be. Let's face it, you can kind of attribute any success to what you want when you want to keep it.
Yeah.
But there is actually life after it. And it, you know, but the don't quit quitting, I guess, would be the thing I'd say. Yeah.
Yeah. And how would you say you look after your own health and well-being? Like, that was a big step. Is there any other things that you would kind of?
Well, look, you can imagine with the life I have and the job I have that I spend a lot of time working. I don't look for any pat on the back for that. I'm very well paid to do that. And I probably always worked beyond hours, so I work weekends. I work most weekends, at least for some share of that. I kind of have a sneaky getaway therapy time, which is I head off to the beach in Ballybunion, which is, you know, a bit of a drive, but nonetheless, it's kind of the place I get to, particularly off season. And when the tide is out there, I can get 7 or 8K out of that. And
That's beautiful.
Myself and I, all three of us together. so that's kind of it. But I love to get out, cut the grass, walk around.
Yeah, there's so much evidence now about getting into blue space and nature. I guess it's common sense. But we're putting evidence to try and drive people out to get that.
Yeah, it is common sense. But I think in a job like this, you do make it difficult. Again, it's a bit like the smoking. I suppose you find reasons not to. So, you know, I'm either sitting behind the wheel of a car, or I'm in an office, and that's pretty intensive. And so it's not the best for lifestyle, because then you don't start eating the best and eating at the wrong times and so on. So we're kind of trying to keep that in check. This is always a great time of the year for that. Spring is back. The evening's a bit of a stretch. It's a bit easier. So yeah, Ballybunion is where it's at. And thankfully most people there don't know me or recognise me. So I just kind of keep going. Yeah.
Our health promotion and improvement staff and our health and wellbeing staff across the country really try and get our health and wellbeing messages out to staff. Mm. And I guess you can see, you know, linked to your retention issues, like our staff, our HR supports around wellbeing and our lifestyle supports around helping wellbeing to staff. They're vital. You know, we, like you said earlier on, our staff are in our community. Their well-being is vital.
Yeah, and I think when you go back to the cynical part, you know, there are parts of our workforce, I think, and there's lots of different local areas where I think there's views, look, the HSE doesn't care about us. People don't even identify with the HSE. So I think there's a way to go with that. People feel pressured, feel under stress, a lot of demands in services, a lot of demands. It's some of our environments are very hard to work in. I still think we've two things going for us. One, I think the satisfaction of doing the work that we do in health and social care always trumps at the end of the day. I think most people come to work to do a good day's work, and I think most people go home feeling they've done something that makes a difference. And the second thing I think that's there is, no matter what supports the employer offers, whether it's health and wellbeing initiatives or whether it's employee assistance, probably the collegiate environment is as important, and the team environment and the spirit of it. And that's why I always worry about the skepticism going to the cynicism, because that can take a team down.
Yeah. You mentioned culture a good few times. Yeah. I guess that links to your cynicism.
Yeah.
Call out, and you mentioned the now and the next, and I'm reminded of our values in action, you know, when you say that, and I suppose that seemed to be a piece of work where we're trying to highlight good values, good behaviours, and to root out some of that.
Yeah, and I don't think you can do that by diktat. You could try, but you can't do it. So even though I talk about the priorities of access and implementation of public confidence, I do ask everyone to view their activity and particularly change through kind of a three prism piece, and that's care, culture, and governance.
Right.
So if I'm doing something, like it might be, you know, one of the best medical changes in a service or in a process, I have to look at the care that that's giving to people and the benefit of that. But I also have to look at the governance within which it's happening to make sure it's appropriate and it's accountable, because it's all right that it goes wrong.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, I have to look at the culture and say, right, what's the appetite for this type of change? What's the rationale for it? How acceptable is it? How focused on the public is it, as opposed to maybe on myself or on the workforce? And culture is that, you know, and there's all the phrases, culture eats strategy for breakfast and all that kind of stuff. And sure, look, it's all great. So those catch lines are fantastic.
You reminded me of some of our change guide recommendations. And I know that those guys are helping out and driving the change program, but they helped me through a couple of projects that were, you know, and really asked those challenging questions about, you know, realistically, when is this change? How is this change going to happen? Is the system ready for it? You know, because I think there's a lot of, like, we all want to be change agents, but...
Yeah, and sure, everyone wants to be kind of doing that kind of stuff and so on. But I mean, ultimately, look, you can look at the culture and you can do culture webs and you can do analysis and so on. And all those things can help. But I think we have to take it back down to the basics and say, look, do we all as individuals that make up the collective of the health service, do we have a shared set of values? Or at least values that we all can ascribe to? But that's not really much good if we're not able to translate those values into the way people experience us and the way we experience each other. And that's the behaviour piece. And that doesn't mean we don't ever lose the head or kind of blow a top or whatever. I do it at least once a week. The point is the awareness of that and the awareness of those behaviours and the awareness of the interactions and the relationships with people. And ultimately, that will dictate how we behave to the public. So what happens when Mrs. O'Neill comes in the door? You know, does she meet a head down?
Yeah, yeah.
Or does she meet a person who's kind of going to go that extra mile? You know, that famous one, you answer the phone and someone says, hello, could I speak to so-and-so, so-and-so? Oh, no, sorry, you've the wrong number. Well, actually, no, you have the wrong number. You're in the wrong place, but I'm going to try and find him for you.
Yeah. Mrs. O'Neill story, just, I know that it's endless, really, but I was just remarking to myself after talking to my parents about, you know, their engagement with the health service and them telling me the conversations that they had with their health professionals. And I thought, they're telling everybody, they're telling all their kids these stories. And they're telling everybody that week about, you know, oh, I seen your man, I got my appointment and he said this and he asked me this. And it's like, you know, that's so central to their care. And then the storytelling, as you said there, that culture, when it's a good experience, it's such, like it's, you know, it just works.
Yeah. And I've heard stories from people, even when they've had a bad experience, I've heard stories from people and they repeatedly talk about the kindness of an individual, the care somebody gave them, the ear somebody gave them, the check-in, the phone back, the phone call. That's indicative of a culture. But that's the part we have to surface and everybody else has to be kind of proud to do that. You can still give out about your employer. You can still give out about the HC. You can give out about me. But that shouldn't be the basis on which then we don't treat other people well in terms of their experience of us.
Yeah. Just before we finish, Bernard, I just want to go back to the change programme. You know, you have six new people.
Yeah.
Big
Friday.
Positions. Yeah, yeah. And I was just looking at their profiles there and you have a mixture of people from that's been through the Irish Health Service and international. What's the next steps for those people now? I know you said you're giving them their responsibility. How do you see those lifting up services in the next 12 months?
So, I mean, it pretty much breaks down like this. They start this Friday. I'm going to spend the whole week with them next week myself. And that really is about including them in a fundamentally different decision-making process. It's about setting the tone. It's about making sure the rest of the HC understands that these six people ultimately, the rest of the organization's job is to support them to lead and to achieve what they're trying to achieve. There's a flip over from March to September because we are switching from a very long-standing system over to a new one. And that includes things like delegations and legal responsibilities and all sorts of other stuff. So, I mean, it's much more complex than it looks. But the next phase for them is the week after next is out on the ground running, meeting their people, building their regions, but the six of them acting in step in terms of consistency. Because what I'm trying to create is a position where the regional executive officer in Dublin Midlands doesn't create a completely different experience for the public to the one in the Midwest. There has to be some reasonable equity. And that's why the six of them reporting to me and working together will make a difference. So we have to focus on embedding that over the next 6 months. And really, I guess, you know, from the public's sense of it, will be that continuous improvement. It's not going to be a big bang. The world isn't going to be better overnight. You know, I keep saying to people, I'm a health service manager, but I'm not Harry Potter.
Yeah,
and so it does take time. It is continuous improvement.
It does seem to be quick, though. Like I've
it's very quick. Like it's one of the quickest changes ever. Yeah.
Because I suppose haven't seen some other changes, and you know, been kind of frustrated sometimes by the way the vested interest and professional groups might slow us down from time to time.
Mm.
And seeing that, like you said earlier, the energy of the announcement of the change is gone before it actually is a practical, real support or change. That the last year, you know, you've come in, you know, with an agenda and you've been...
Yeah, and I think the difference is, look, there's lots of consultation goes on about the design and co-design and organising the structure. But I did make it clear to people, it would be disingenuous to say to people I was going to consult with people about the core structure of the centre or the six regions at the top line. I wasn't. Because if I did, the timely implementation factor will be gone. There had to be a principal decision made. The decision to create six regions was made before I came. And I'm very lucky, the board of the HSC, the department, the minister, you know, I've had lots of support from government to drive that on. So it is, it is in the 18 years of the HSC, it's the fastest nationwide structure change. But the real test of that, as I say, will be in what's the quality of the service and the experience of people. And I guess in terms of these six leaders, I mean, the amount of energy I'm investing in that, as opposed to the rest of the organisation, is to say that probably in 12 months' time, you'll see more of them and less of me.
Oh, really? That's good.
And that should be a sign that those regions are real entities.
Yeah.
That they're real places focused on their population. And my job at the centre is to help them do that.
Okay. Where do you get the drive from? You seem to have a lot of... like get up and go and just kind of no messing, let's get this thing done.
Well, look, I mean, you know, I keep reminding people I'm very fortunate. You know, I've had a wonderful career to date. You know, I was a social care worker, I was a caretaker, I was lots of different things. And then about 24 or 5 years ago, someone decided to give me a job as a manager. And then I studied management and I went back and studied a bit in my own time to do that. I guess, fundamentally, I really am a very privileged person. People keep talking to me about the difficult job I have, you know, and people say to me, you have 150,000 staff, you've budgeted 23 billion. How do you sleep at night? I sleep very easily, actually, most of the time. Times I don't sleep so well, and when there's a real worry for the public well-being. But I'm very privileged to not just lead this organisation, but I've led TUSLA as well. So, you know, I'm one of the few people who gets that kind of privilege in life to be the CEO of two major state organisations. And that's just something that's handed to me for the time I have it. And the thing is, I love being a public servant. I absolutely love being a public servant. I have never had a job that I didn't like or I wouldn't go back to. I absolutely love being a public servant. I never thought I'd be the CEO of the HSC. I never set out to be the CEO.
Right.
I thought I'd retire this year out of TUSLA, actually. So I know this is my last turn in the public service.
Right.
This is my last turn. So I cross my fingers when I say that, but this is my last turn. And you know what? I'll have plenty of time for myself when I'm finished. So I have a short window and I have to drive on. And that's really where it comes from. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks for that honesty. So Bernard, I'd like to thank you for coming on to the podcast today and for sharing those valuable insights for our listeners.
Enjoyed it.
And I'd like to thank the listeners for tuning in to another episode of the HSE Talking Health and Wellbeing podcast.